From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm honored to be sitting across from the Pulitzer Prize winning, Tony Award winning actor, playwright, Tracy Letts, who's found a way to sort of bring gothic noir into almost everything he does, with the exception of maybe Man from Nebraska and one of my favorite plays of the 21st century, Superior Donuts. But he's here to talk about the adaptation of his play, August Osage County, which is now a film directed by John Wells. First of all, thanks so much for being here, Tracy.
Thanks for having me.
And the idea of gothic noir, I mean, it really sort of pervades a lot of what you do.
I suppose. I don't know. I don't know that that's conscious necessarily. I'm influenced by everything. So once you put it all in the stew pot, the way it comes out, it is kind of, I don't know. It's. I hope it's very human, but there is a darkness or a macabre side to some of the stuff I do.
So many of the characters, I think about Bug or about Violet in Osage County, these characters kind of know that they're bigger than life and have a presentational aspect to them. And I wonder where that comes from for you.
I suppose it comes just from a certain size of personality of people in my family or people I grew up with. But I also just think dramatists, natural-born dramatists, they have a knack for finding some of those larger pieces of people. Or, when Steinbeck was writing Grapes of Wrath, he talked about describing the Jodes, trying to find the over-essence was his word, you know. So I think with those characters, there is something larger and more dramatic in their personalities, naturally.
One of the reasons I said noir is that sort of sense of, even in Bug, there's six inches where there's no dialogue. That sort of sense of creating tension and making the audience sort of lean in closer because they're waiting for something to be said. And
right.
That sort of that combination of sort of fear and tension from silence you get from noir is very much a part of the way you work as a playwright even.
Yeah. Well, Pulp Fiction, that kind of fiction has always appealed to me. Jim Thompson was a big influence. A kind of terse style, and what you'd often find in a Jim Thompson character is though they would express themselves, I want a cup of coffee, or boy, she's a good-looking woman, but was also actually masking, perhaps they might be a psychopath, perhaps they might just be a sort of raging, amoral beast, but it was masked by this very terse language. I always found that creepy and also kind of realistic. You know, our language is masking who we really are in some ways.
Because I don't know if you're much of a comics reader, but I almost get this sense of thought balloons over your characters' heads when I'm watching the plays.
Right.
That silence for me sort of communicates. We're supposed to be sort of reading captions over them or something like that.
Right. I don't know. Sometimes I'm not a big believer in subtext necessarily. Sometimes I just ask them to speak the subtext.
I'm sorry, you're not a big believer in subtext?
Yeah,
did you say that out loud? We're recording this. You know this, right?
No, I mean, I guess I'm not a big believer that. I suppose what I should say is that I'm not writing a lot of subtext and then having them say something else. I'm having them say what they say. Often in the writing process, they're revealing themselves to me as well. Some of that process is very mysterious to me, and sometimes the characters are mysterious, and sometimes they surprise me by what they say or what they don't say. I know that sounds a little odd. I'll give you a good example. Uncle Charlie in August Osage County. I had written him as this, slightly befuddled but comfortable guy in the upholstery business who had married into this family. That moment where he stands up to his wife was a complete shock to me. It was never part of the original conception of the thing. Suddenly I'm riding along and suddenly this guy had a lot to say that I didn't know he had to say. I didn't know he had it in him to say it, frankly. And suddenly the piece changed for me because, like, wow, look at what that guy's got to say. It's something about the writing process is very subconscious for me. In a way, say that acting is not. I mean, right, as an actor, I know that my job is
to take other people's words and translate them, make sense out of them. But as a writer, it's a very strange subconscious process in which I can be taken by surprise frequently.
But see, as you're saying this, I just find myself thinking, as you were saying, you're talking about that, and that sort of burst of honesty, or that belief that something had to be said, is almost the way an actor would think about it. What, how do I deal with this problem? And that sounds like an actor's approach to me as you were describing it.
Probably is. Probably comes from my training as an actor, or my those moments as an actor that I find really surprising to myself, or a moment where I find the mystery of an actor, right? The moment where you're holding information back, where you're simply not revealing to the audience what you're feeling in that given moment. Those moments have terrific power on stage and on film as well.
Because what you're talking about is that thing that, you can go back to Stanislavski, and at some point when you find the character, a kind of possession takes place, almost automatic writing.
Right.
And this is what you're talking about a little bit in this writing, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, like I say, I think it's a matter of sort of tapping into something that's operating in me on a very subconscious level. I'm not. Every time I start a play, I look up at the shelf where I have plays that I've written, and I say, I don't know how I did that. I don't know how one does that. I don't know how you write a play. Nobody can write a play. And then I start writing, and eventually I have a play at the end of it.
Talk about the first play you wrote then.
Killer Joe was the first play I wrote. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it, you know, with the idea that I was going to try to... Well, as I say, I was a fan of noir fiction, pulp fiction, and so I thought, geez, I've never not seen a lot of it on stage.
Almost never seen it on stage.
And I think it's, I don't know, I think it's ripe material for a dramatist. And I thought, I wonder if there's a way to contain it within the parameters of the stage and tell this kind of story. At the same time, I was trying to write something, you know, it was kind of purpose-built in a way. It's a small play. It could be done on a single set. It could be done with five young actors, which makes for a certain ease of production and a portability of a play like that, right? That we could take our production and then take it to Edinburgh and then take it to London from there. So it was purpose-built in a lot of ways. But again, the subconscious part of it kind of surprised me, and I realized that in order to do it well, I was going to have to make it personal. So I found that all of these characters were representing some part of my personality and some pretty dark parts of my personality, some damaged parts of me. And I just kind of allowed myself to express those damaged parts of me in the play, and found that it made the material very rich and very actor-friendly. Actors were eager to get their hands on it and do it, always have had good luck in that regard, that actors enjoy doing my work. So my family, when they first came to see Killer Joe, they were sort of shocked and horrified because they saw how much of it was personal, that I was expressing a lot of pain, personal pain in the piece, that it wasn't just... something I'd created outside of myself. It was part of me.
It's a treatment. I'm surprised by my guest, playwright, actor, Tracy Letts, whose newest piece is August Osage County, which has now been done as a film directed by John Wells. As you were talking about, that sense of surprise that lives in everything you've written must be a big part of your life, because I was thinking about the thing that clearly is and you like to test, I think, audiences and people. I mean, Violet is somebody who sort of constantly dares the audience to sort of figure out their feeling about the material. And, right. Of course, there's a scene with the chicken.
Yeah.
In Killer Joe. When you wrote that scene, you must have thought, did you think, where did that come from? Or
yeah, I still think, where did that come from? I still look at that scene and say, I couldn't be in the theater when they were rehearsing the scene. I found it so disturbing. I had to leave the theater while the scene was
being rehearsed. Describe for the audience a little, because I don't want to say too
much. Well, the Killer Joe Cooper is interrogating the person who's been behind the plot. And once...
We should say he's both a cop and an enforcer.
Yes. And once he's exposed her, he punishes her by forcing her to fillet a chicken leg, an act of simulated rape. And It's horrible to watch. It's a humiliating and agonizing moment in the theater. And it's always been very divisive in terms of the response, transgressive even perhaps, as an act of theater, because, of course, you know, the actress playing the part is actually filleting the chicken leg. It's horrible to watch, but it seemed necessary at the time. But yeah, where it comes from in my I can't pinpoint it.
But that sort of sense of power being used recklessly,
right,
is so it's fascinating to me, because it's where the tension comes from, and so often in the work, and it's a big part of August Osage County. That thing you're talking about, where people aren't conscious of what they do. It maybe it's an actor you have to figure out that subtext you're talking about when you're writing it, though. It's just this kind of wanton and abandoned display of, or use of power.
Yeah, well, I thought Killer Joe was a lot about power and the use of power and who's got the power in this family. And in fact, when I was accused of misogyny, which happened frequently and still happens even since the Friedkin film of a couple of years ago, I always kind of felt like, gee, I thought if there was a problem with it, it wore its feminist heart on its sleeve a bit too much. I thought quite the opposite, but that's not necessarily how everybody was reading it.
I think, too, and as a member of Steppenwolf, we were talking about this before we got started, there's a kind of intensity, I think, physicality in that theater that also lends itself to the kind of writing you do, where it's so much about that moment and just almost white-knuckling the audience, at least, what's going to happen next. It almost feels like being in that crucible formed you in some way.
Oh, absolutely. Chicago theater is, aside from being a rigorous environment for its artists, it's certainly where I learned my craft as an actor and learned most of what I know as a writer from working on those stages. And, you know, when they started Steppenwolf Theater, those guys who started it, Gary Sinise, Jeff Perry, Terry Kenney, they talked about they kind of wanted to make movies on stage. Of course, it's not like that at all. What they were actually talking about doing was provoking the kinds of feelings in the audience that they themselves felt when they were at the movies. There's an intimacy in Chicago theater. You know, most of the work is done in small storefronts, and so quite often the actors are just feet away from the audiences. And so it provides a very intense environment in which to perform plays, in which to produce human drama in front of people, and sort of gets back to the original notions of why we do theater in the first place. And Killer Joe was absolutely a very conscious decision to write in that mold. And, you know, the play was originally done in a 40-seat theater with that trailer almost on top of the audience, and was really in your face from the very first moments. Nudity, sex, blood, drugs, fights. You know, there was a real graphic quality to the play.
But even when I saw it, though, and it wasn't in that small space, but I felt like it reminded me of the old ideals of punk performance art.
Right. I think so, absolutely. I mean, I even had the bright idea. I wasn't thinking of it as a marketing idea at the time, but we rated our play X. We told people, you know, you're not going to bring your kids into this because we didn't want to lure people in who didn't know what they were getting and then hit them over the head with a chair. We wanted people to know this is really risky. It's really graphic. Of course, the X helped sell us a lot of tickets in the theater, though it had the opposite effect in the cinema. As it does.
Yeah, as it does. We will take a break. There's more to talk about with Tracy Letts, whose newest work is the adaptation of August Osage County, directed by John Wells. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I was digressing with my guest, Tracy Letts, whose new film is the adaptation of August Osage County. This is a part of the show you get to tell the audience what the movie's about.
Oh, the movie is about an Oklahoma family in which the patriarch goes missing, and the three daughters return home to wait for his return with their mother, who's very troubled and difficult woman and troubled by drug addiction. And it's big family drama, big sloppy, sprawling family drama.
And the cast includes?
Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts and Chris Cooper. And, oh, my God, there's too many of them. I'll never remember them all.
And Ewan McGregor and Abigail Breslin and Julianne Nicholson and
Juliette Lewis.
Yes, and one of my favorite bits is just having Sam Shepard do Hollow Men at the beginning.
Right.
I really just remember hearing that and just sitting up when I heard that, this is going to be kind of interesting. But it's subtext and not a chorus. So right. It really doesn't sort of like predict what's going to happen, but it certainly gives us basically a piece of meat to hold on to when you start.
Yeah.
And that's why I was wondering how you arrived at using that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say another goal in the creation of it was that so often as an Oklahoman, which I am originally, you know, we're portrayed as hicks and rednecks for the most part.
And people who don't, this weird thing about people from the Plains states, and even the Westerns, they never talk. If you ever go any place, that part of the world, people always talk. So that kind of weird stereotype of the silent Plains state resident is kind of ridiculous to me.
Right, yeah. No, I grew up around academics. Both my folks were English teachers.
Well, your mom's a novelist.
My mom's novelist.
Your dad played that part on stage.
Yes, he did.
But I just wonder, when you give that play to your dad, and what that conversation was like.
Well, the scarier part was when I gave it to my mom, because she had lived it. We'd all lived it. My grandfather had committed suicide my mother's father had committed suicide when I was 10 by drowning himself. And my grandmother then descended into years of drug addiction, downer addiction, and just put my family through hell. So I was scared to give the play to my mother because I knew it was going to hit a lot of personal stuff for her. And her first response after reading it was, "You've been very kind to my mother." Yeah, to the character of Violet was representative of my grandmother. But I had, you know, my father, I had used him as a resource. I had gone to him to ask him a lot of questions about that time, about what had happened, you know, because at the time I was just dealing with my memories as a 10-year-old kid trying to sift through all that. So I went back to Dad to get some of the facts, and Dad asked me at some point, he said, "Why are you writing about this? Where does this come from?" And I said, "Well, Dad, it's haunted me since I was a little kid." And he said, "It has?" My folks, you know,
this is going to be a scene from the play.
Well, it's one of the things that happens in the play, right?
Yes.
They ignore the kid to a certain extent. But, you know, sometimes adults take their eye off the ball. Sometimes the best parents take their eye off the ball. There's a moment it's in the film and in the play when Violet is very mean to the little girl at the table. And it was always, I say little girl, it's Abigail Breslin.
She's a teenager.
15, 16 years old. And it was always the actor's impulse to reach out and to take care of the little girl, to reach out and grab her hand or say it's okay or console her in some way. And I would never let the actors do it. And they would say, "How can we as parents not console her in that moment?" I said, "Because if you do that, you're parenting well. And in this story, they're not parenting well. They're not bad people. They're good people who aren't being very good parents right now."
Well, that's the thing that's really so scary about the play, and it really functions more centrally in the film than it does in the play. In the play, you're just kind of aware of it because she's there on stage all the time, just being sort of bounced around.
Right.
But because of that compression that you've done in the film, it becomes much more central.
Yeah. Well, I made a conscious decision to bring Barbara as the protagonist to the foreground of the piece. You don't have the luxury in a film that you do in a play, which is unfortunate. But so I made a decision to foreground her. And by doing that, and also, of course, by the nature of the camera, directing the eye, you know, right? We're telling you where to look. You can see the character of Jean that Abigail plays being ignored. You can see her, and because she's ignored, she's vulnerable, which, you know, Steve, another character in the piece, takes advantage of.
Well, she's vulnerable, so she's both kind of punished and prey. And then she becomes really the sort of the soul that everybody's kind of either ignoring or fighting for, in the way that she, and we can sort of see the sort of connection between her and Violet in the way that you didn't sort of foreground so much in the play.
You know, I guess the more I think about this, the more it feels like we know the right thing to do with kids. We know the right way to be families and to parent. Here in 2014, we've got it all figured out. But of course we don't. And I think that's always been part of the appeal of August Osage County. Dysfunctional families, and by the word dysfunctional is never a word we used while we were creating the piece, but that's the catchphrase, dysfunctional families. That's not something from the past. That's something that exists today. Somebody's not parenting well right now. I promise you they're not. And so that's kind of the story we're getting at to some extent with August Osage County. We're telling the story of our very imperfect unit by which we govern and raise our species. It's very imperfect, but it's all we got.
My guest who's casting aspersions on the parenting skills of 310 Erie Code is Tracy Letts, whose newest work is the adaptation of August Osage County, directed by John Wells. It's The Treatment. I guess what I just find so fascinating about the works is, and so often in these things you've done as a writer, we're watching somebody who realizes their time is passing. I mean, it goes to Superior Donuts, to some extent in Man of Nebraska too, because he can't figure out where to plant himself, and the world is passing him by. We even get to hear it said in August Osage, kind of the line almost could to sort of any of your plays, well, thank God we don't know what the future's going to be. If we did, we'd never get out of bed. I mean, right. The idea of time being a character is really important to you.
Yeah, it is, because because being a human being is sad. It is. It's sad. I mean, when you think about it, when you look at it, it's, you know, it's hard. And the passage of time is hard. And do you know how often we talk about that? Just people sitting around talk about, oh, I'm getting old. Oh, I can't do this. I'm getting old. Oh, the way it used to be. Not even necessarily in some sort of crabby old man thing about, let me tell you how it used to be so much better, because it wasn't really. But we talk about the time that's slipping away or that has slipped away, because that's what's actually happening. Your time is slipping away right now, Elvis, while you're talking to me. It's dripping out.
No, this is going to be preserved forever, this piece of time. Let me explain to you how this works here. This moment will be crystallized and bounced around the internet for as long as there, another 15, 20 years, as long as there's an internet, this will exist. I just wondered for you, this is your third adaptation now. If you were aware of the power, I mean, does this sort of shock you how powerful these pieces are when they're turned into films? Because there's a sort of sense that you can sort of look away a little bit in the play or disengage and not feel and feel like if you look away from the actor, you feel like you're not that involved. But that the power of a movie, it's still hitting you. And I just wonder how that affects you, seeing the enormity, really, of these pieces you've done as films.
Well, it affects me greatly, though I'm not objective about it at all, because I've grown up with the pieces first on the typewriter and then later in the theater and then later in the cinema. But I am aware of the power of it, and I myself am still affected by it. I mean, August is deeply personal to me. I can't watch the movie without crying. I was never able to watch the play without crying. It gets at some really personal stuff for me, personal expression. And some of it's very sad. Some of it's not. Some of it's a lot of fun, but some of it is very sad. So, yeah, I'm aware. I hope it's powerful. I hope people are being moved. I mean, what are we doing here?
I'm asking you questions, but what I'm trying to ask is if it shocks you, the weight of these things, because if we get back to, again, that sort of definition of trying to sort of transform the theater experience, which you grew up in as an actor and were formed by as a playwright in that cauldron, the fact is that there's going to be an amount of heat and energy and passion that these things throw off that things that are conceived for the movies do not.
Right.
And I just wonder how that hits you and if you end up thinking back about the germination of the plays because of that.
Yeah, I'm definitely taken back to what was, I mean, watching Killer Joe, for instance, Mr. Friedkin's movie from a couple of years ago, and seeing that power play happen late in that piece, the chicken leg scene we were talking about. And I am transported back to the original impulse that created it, the subconscious thing that made it. And I'm absolutely struck by the power of it to affect an audience. I mean, the pieces are all divisive, right? They've always been divisive. They have their champions and they have vehement detractors. Personally, I like that. I mean, I think that speaks of a strong point of view. You know, I think it's the things that don't have a strong point of view that tend to get sort of more across the board reaction. I like the idea that the pieces force a reaction. And what I came to believe about Killer Joe after a while, after I'd lived with the piece for a while, because these responding to charges of misogyny, or I began to believe that the piece was a kind of test for the person watching it. And in fact, they were having, it was saying more about them, and their response to the piece said more to me about them than it did about the piece itself. I like that the various pieces seem to kind of challenge the audience in that way.
It's what I was saying in the first half. There's some point there's a character or an idea that basically draws a line in the sand in every one of these plays that you've written.
Right. Absolutely. You know, August Osage County, I hope it's actually asking the audience a question about, well, she's your mother. What would you do? What would you do? You stay? Do you go? Do you work on it? Do you pretend it's not going on? What do you do? Because I got news for you. She is your mother.
And it gets back to what you were saying before, that relationship with power. I mean, for whatever reason, people are often will sit around it just because there's something kind of alluring about it. Just watching power being used in kind of baleful ways or seductive ways is something that I think at the core we're all compelled to be around. And that compunction is something that you wanted to dramatize.
Yeah, it is. It is because we do that. I mean, that's one of the things we do. We do work our power on other people, effectively or ineffectively, but we're always doing it. We're doing it every day. And I don't mind that people if they watch my stuff that they find themselves asking that question or challenged by that or even angered by it.
That's a great point, Dan. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being here, Tracy. Really, thank you.
Thanks, Elvis.
My pleasure. My guest is Tracy Letts, whose newest work, Don't Be Afraid, is August Osage County, the film version directed by John Wells. My recording engineer, who also mixes the show's Melissa Morton, is edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I've got the power. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.